I'm Anna Richardson, and I'm uncovering the truth.
The brain can be awake and asleep at the same time.
No.
Absolutely.
I'm busting the myths.
Of course you don't have to lie down. People get pregnant having sex standing up behind the bike shed.
About your health. How can you persuade me to take up jogging? My pelvic floor isn't strong enough. Health, fact versus fiction from HCA Healthcare UK. Listen or subscribe now on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to the BBC Countryfile magazine podcast, the podcast that takes you on great escapes into the outdoors, meets fascinating rural people and tackles some of the big issues facing our countryside. My name is Fergus Collins and I'll be your host today. As Easter is on the horizon, this week we're talking about holy walks in the countryside, pilgrimages old and new to shrines and sacred places. My guest is historian Dr. Emma Wells of the University of York, an expert in medieval life, pilgrimages and religious sites. And she's going to tell us why pilgrimages were so important and even suggest a few modern day ones for us to tackle. So when was the heyday of the pilgrimage, would you say? And what were pilgrimages? Two huge questions, really.
The sort of zenith apogee of pilgrimage in the past was sort of from the mid to late Middle Ages, sort of 13th to 15th century, arguably, of course. But in fact, in Britain, pilgrimage began, well, even before there were Christians. So the amazing prehistoric trackways that we often walk upon, that we love to track upon even to this day, which were a lore unto themselves, they have shown the way to our ancestors for millennia. For example, the chalky trails of the English Downs, they can still be traced, they're still walked upon, and they have been done so for thousands of years, continuing their existence as sort of subtle landmarks, changed across the landscapes, and sort of they've been ingrained with a mysticism of the past, which is sort of akin to very much a spiritual pilgrimages, which, as I say, modern pilgrims still want to conquer, still want to walk across.
So is that places like the Ridgeway then? Would you say that's a pilgrimage route?
Yes, indeed. I mean, a lot of them have sort of transpired and transformed over the years. So they might have begun as trade routes, for example, mining routes, trade routes to the coast, and then slowly and slowly upon time became pilgrim routes. And they are now what we would call our sort of walking routes today, in fact.
So would people have walked along the Ridgeway to places like Avebury? Would that have been a sort of pilgrimage route then in the past?
Yes, absolutely. Sort of many of the places that we see as spiritual landmarks, not only spiritual landmarks, but religious landmarks and spiritual landmarks, people would have journeyed to them. This is slightly perhaps before and after the sort of time of pilgrimage, the age of faith that we think of, the medieval pilgrimage that we think of. But indeed, people still certainly walked to these very spiritual holy sites for whatever reason we're still trying to find out. But absolutely, for many hundreds, thousands of years, absolutely, yes.
And so why go on pilgrimage? I mean, you talked about those ancient times where we don't know, we don't have the evidence. But in more modern times, say medieval period, which I think of as a sort of medieval, as a sort of heyday of pilgrimages, but yes. Why?
Well, many reasons, really. So pilgrimages to holy spiritual places, they enabled the faith to essentially atone for your sins, to seek miraculous cures and to extend experience of the world. So it wasn't just one particular reason. But what they were going to see, largely, were the bodily remains of the saints or holy bodies or holy relics and the objects associated with them. So we think, for example, at Chartres, we have the Virgin's mantle. We have a lot of saints in Britain as well. They were the sort of star attractions for pilgrims. And they might travel very short distances to see and touch the shrines of these local saints, you know, a few days like Chaucer's pilgrims took, or they might undertake more ambitious and dangerous journeys as well. I mean, we often think of the very long journeys to Canterbury or Walsingham or, you know, abroad to Santiago or Lourdes, but actually they weren't just these very arduous journeys. You may just travel to your local parish church, and they were much more common. And so the sort of motivation was penance, ridding yourself of one sin. And when you got to the church, you could do so in various forms. And largely in the medieval period, unfortunately, it was money. So you could pay for what we would call an indulgence. And it was sort of a form of insurance. A remission of sin was therefore earned either by prayer or, as they say, through usually a donation. And that would release you from your time in purgatory. That's, you know, the limbo between heaven and earth. So, you know, if indulgences were therefore used to encourage visits to shrine sites, to encourage pilgrims, and ultimately, I suppose, led to the idea of buying salvation. But people could also go for other reasons, such as simply from, as I say, they might want a cure for an illness before Western medicine, or simply the hope of a better harvest, or just to have a day out even. It wasn't just, you know, the expectation of miracles, but for everyday eases and cures in a world without sort of medicine or, you know, modern day theme parks, as it were.
Yeah, okay. I'm quite interested in this idea that people might actually have gone on these walks to experience a bit of the world, which is kind of what we try and extol in the magazine. But I think a lot of listeners might think, oh gosh, in medieval times people didn't leave their villages, and were people a bit more sort of adventurous than we give them credit for? And perhaps, you know, everyone was moving around a bit more. And perhaps in modern days today, we're not as mobile as perhaps our ancestors were.
Well, I think we're perhaps going more to what the medieval period was like. Certainly people travelled. But as I say, the sort of very long, torturous, arduous journeys to the very large shrine sites such as Canterbury, Durham before that, Walsingham, etc., they would be once-in-a-lifetime opportunities. You didn't have sick pay. You didn't have holiday pay, remember. So you had to work year in, year out, and all year round. Therefore, you couldn't simply go off to pilgrimage whenever you felt like it, as it were. You did have to plan for it. And in fact, you would need to go to your local parish church and see your local parish priest in order to do so and make the vow of pilgrimage. And in fact, you could also, and what many people did, put it in their will that someone else would go on their behalf for them when they died, right, which is an easy way of doing it.
Yeah, that's a bit onerous to hand that on to someone else to do.
Absolutely.
So I can think of several pilgrimage routes. Obviously, I did the Canterbury Tales at school, and that's quite a romantic idea of leaving London and travelling across the North Downs to Canterbury. But what other great routes in the UK are there? I mean, we're focusing on the UK in the magazine, but what big ones could you point out to readers? And perhaps one of your favourites?
Well, there are quite a few. In my book, Pilgrim Routes of the British Isles, I sort of bring up my seventh favourite. But within that, I do discuss perhaps the most popular within England, which is Walsingham. And this has been perhaps one of England's premier sites for hundreds of years. In fact, 250,000 pilgrims still to this day every year descend upon the Norfolk village of Walsingham. It's the site of the 11th century shrine of the Virgin Mary. And in fact, it's self-branded England's Nazareth. So that sort of shows just how important it is. And we see now, I think in 2010, it was something like 250,000 people go there and went there in 1 year. So this just shows just how important it is. But there is there's the Walsingham Way, which is a sort of pilgrim route towards Walsingham. It's about 70 miles or so, which begins at the shrine site of St. Etheldreda's at Ely Cathedral, passes by the ruins of Castle Lake Priory, so beautiful landscape, And Caslake Priory was the first Cluniac monastery in England. And then it culminates at the Slipper Chapel at Walsingham, where the shrine and relics of the Virgin were housed in the little village, which is about sort of halfway between Norwich and the town of King's Lynn. And just to note, the Slipper Chapel is quite interesting because so it's located about some miles south of Walsingham. It was built around the early 14th century, and it's the last pilgrim chapel before the village. And its unusual name derives from the pilgrims who would remove their shoes, and then they would walk barefoot the rest of the way to Walsingham. And what's quite interesting about this, the whole site at Walsingham, is that it was reconsecrated. At the Reformation, obviously, it fell out of favour. But in the early 20th century, it became a shrine again, and hence why it's become such an important site to particularly the Catholic faith.
Okay, and
as well,
are people still doing that journey from Ely to Walsingham?
I mean, absolutely.
So this sort of 250,000 people who do it every year are doing the walk, or are some of them driving?
Some of them are certainly driving. Some of them are just tourists, of course. Yes. But there are many people who descend upon the route and follow the route itself because it's such an important Catholic shrine. You know, its spirituality is still imbued there. It is the number one shrine within England, the primary Catholic shrine still. So that is where you would go within England, and you would encounter the Virgin there. So there's nothing really like it. It's the closest you will experience, I think, to a medieval shrine in England.
Now seems an appropriate time to have a little taste of medieval pilgrimages through the words of Geoffrey Chaucer and his Canterbury Tales.
One that Abril with his sure sota, the drocht of March hath pierced to the rota, and bathed every vine in switch liquor, of which vertu engendred is the fleur. When Zephyrus eck with his suete breathe, in spirit hath in every alt and eth, the tendre cropes and the young sona, hath in the ram his have course erona. And smale foles make an melodie, that sleppen all the nicht in open ear. So precketh hem natur in hill garages, than longen folk to gone on pilgrimages. And parmes for to second strange strondes to ferne halwes, quoth in sondre londes. And specially from every shires of Ingolande to Canterbury they wende, the holy blissful matter for to seca, than him hath helpen when that they were seca.
But for this Easter, I thought it was quite interesting you mentioned the small pilgrimages to the local church, to the local parish church. Everyone has one of these within reach of them. They're such a feature of the British landscape. But why? Why parish church absolutely everywhere?
Well, I suppose the parish churches, of course, tell the tale of about 15 years of our English, as you say, history, and in fact, social change. They are, to this day, an integral part of English life, social life and culture. Back sort of in the medieval era, in the Middle Ages, the church was central to community life. It seems to have sort of suited everyone until we get to the Reformation, of course. But daily life for the vast majority of the population was closely bound to the local parish church. It was the focal point of a community. So everyone within a church's sphere of influence would gather within it to worship together, of course. And they were led through the mysteries of the sacrament by the local priest. So as with cathedrals, the local parish church was essentially a machine for worship, albeit on a smaller scale. And its architecture performed much of the same thing. So the dissemination of ideas through teaching based on scripture and biblical text was an important way of enforcing moral code within a community. So, you know, your parish church was at the heart of it. Religion was there. And this was a way to teach everything else about life itself. And therefore, the parish church was attended, at least in theory, on Sundays and religious festivals by the majority. However, and that's what we often think about the medieval period, everyone went to parish church. The parish church was the sort of main focus of society, and they were always there. They were always attending. But that's not quite the case. There is quite a lot of evidence to suggest that people didn't bother as much with religion as we might assume. they didn't always go to church on a Sunday. And there's many reports of priests reporting to his bishop that hardly anyone was coming to the church on a Sunday. In fact, they were larking about in the streets playing. And other records give the sense that at least a sizable minority enjoyed themselves elsewhere on a Sunday morning. So it appears that Sundays were not church-going days.
Ah, that's so interesting. I mean, people love visiting churches. I think I find them always magnetically attracted to a church in a village, and there's something when you open that squeaky door and go inside, you never know what to find. If you had to visit five churches, for example, where would you suggest?
Oh, gosh, it's so difficult. A couple I could give. Okay, so one would certainly be, well, I think Norfolk in general has just some of the best churches, some of my favourite churches. This is down to survival of sort of medieval survivals, what's there in the churches left. Same with Cornwall, but Norfolk and Suffolk particularly have a great deal of medieval survivals.
Emma, when you say survival, do you mean survival of the Reformation? So a lot was lost during the Reformation. Is that what you mean?
Yes, that's certainly true. And a lot of them do have evidence of what happened at the Reformation as well. And in fact, so one of my favourites is Ranworth. And it's an icon of the Norfolk Broads. It has a 14th century tower, which stands high above the River Bure and looks out over the Malthouse Broad. It's known as the Cathedral of the Broads. And in fact, it still has three outstandingly important 15th century historical treasures, which include a magnificent painted rood screen, an illuminated book known as the Ranworth Antiphoner, and a superbly carved cantor's desk. The church itself was built around the mid-15th century on the site of an earlier church. And the reason it became such an affluent church and just an extremely wonderful church, I suppose, in architectural terms, is that the local medieval wool trade brought wealth to local merchants, and they lavished their riches on the church, and therefore it became one of the finest in the country. The church would have been very much separate sections for different people, and it was very much squared off, I suppose. These sections were squared off. So as we walk into churches today, they are very grand, open spaces. They're very plain spaces. So one thing to note, first of all, is that the parish church and indeed our cathedrals were entirely painted in primary colours. So they were awash with colour, vivid, bright colours. We completely forget that today because they are just we just see the stonework, I suppose, the white, plain stonework.
Yeah, completely but whitewashed or the naked stone, yeah.
Absolutely. But they weren't. They were covered in blues, reds, yellows, gold, gilding. So, you know, just imagine something that was covered in colour. The closest we see is in Germany, you can still see these types, that sort of era, you can still see these types of churches. But it's very hard to fathom. So when one would walk in, depending on who you were, if you were just a regular layman, I suppose, your domain, as I say, would be the nave. If you were of higher society, you may have a chantry chapel to the, say, the, in the north. So the northeastern chapel would be your domain. And you would have essentially bought that chantry chapel. And what that meant was you would have a priest there who would be just there to take services for you and to say those services for your soul even after you had died, and you might be interred there once you have died. And the entire chapel itself would have been created for you in association and dedication to your saint, whoever that might have been. And then you had the chancel, the sanctuary area, which was essentially the priest's domain. And they would be, what I think we forget is they would be facing east. So they have their back to you. And then there was these screens everywhere. So you very much don't see much of what's going on, particularly during the Eucharist. You don't see what's going on. You're in the nave.
So how did you get into ecclesiastical history? What journey did you take to get there?
I've always been very much interested in in understanding an experience in the past through historic buildings, I suppose, historic sites as a whole. So when I look at it from that approach, and I began my sort of academic career via art history, actually, and I was very much drawn to the medieval ecclesiastical buildings. So I was drawn to the stained glass and the portal sculpture of our great cathedrals, and I went that way and then looked at the medieval saints who were pictured within them, and, you know, how were people thinking about them? How were people perceiving, experiencing these saints? You know, were they being taught by these magnificent buildings or not? And how are they experiencing them in a different way that we do today? So a particular approach that I take is sensory experience. So, you know, how did they taste, smell, touch, etc., in a different way that we do today? And so I went that way in my PhD was in pilgrimage art and architecture of the medieval church. So I was looking at how shrines and the surrounding and associated art and architecture developed in relation to providing pilgrims with a much more intense and engaged sensory experience. You know, were churches catering for pilgrims? You know, were they providing many more relics and much more of an integrative experience in terms of the art and architecture for pilgrims themselves, in order that they would, you know, come and visit and give them more money? But in a way, it is like modern day theme parks, modern day tourist attractions. The more large rides you have, the more people want to come visit. So the more relics, the more shrines you have, the more interest in architecture, the more pilgrims are going to come.
Underlying slight monetary thinking here, that they might be able to generate some, or certainly commercially minded.
Absolutely.
Prepare for amazing. The all-new Lexus UX self-charging hybrid is here. The new compact SUV model from Lexus that challenges everything that went before. Daring in design, dynamic to drive, with class-leading fuel efficiency and imaginative technology. The UX is a car with a unique presence on the road. Book your UX test drive today at Lexus Wolverhampton and experience amazing for yourself. Search Lexus Wolverhampton to discover more.
The methods used by criminals have always evolved. You're now 40% more likely to be a victim of cybercrime than of burglary. With Hiscox CyberClear, you're covered for all cyber threats, even the ones that don't exist yet. Search Hiscox Cyber Insurance.
Churches obviously parish churches have had their important role. And some still do play an absolutely fundamental role in the bonding of a community. But a lot of them lie empty and rather unloved. Do you see a future for them as part of communities, or some other role that they could play?
Well, that's a very loaded question in these current climes. But actually, I think this is a very important question, a very important problem. I think, of course, congregations are dwindling, and there are indeed ways that we could bring people back into churches. Secular activities is one way of doing so, whether one agrees with that or not. It certainly gets people through the doors. Whether they convert to churchgoers is another matter. However, there are some wonderful trusts and societies, such as the Church's Conservation Trust. I teach the postgraduate diploma in parish churches at York in association with the Church's Conservation Trust. And they are specifically there to deal with the churches that are sort of not in use, as it were. They're still consecrated, but there isn't the congregation there anymore to keep them going. And there's also the Friends of the Friendless Churches, redundant churches, etc. So I personally think that trusts and societies like this are the way forward, because they understand and they realise the importance of the fact that church buildings are not there only to be a church for missional purposes, which of course is the primary role, but a lot of these buildings are some of our greatest greatest heritage assets, you know, our greatest architectural material marvels. So we do need to ensure that they are still there in 100 years, 200 years, 1,000 years, in the same way that they have been. So I think that's perhaps the way to go. And, you know, they come up with several different ways of opening their doors, whether it's from, you know, using them as filming locations to having wonderful sort of Christmas candlelight events, you know, seeing what how a church in the medieval era would have felt, would have been, you know, visiting events such as those.
I saw your tweet about sleeping in a church and the delight about that. Could they be opened up as sort of not glamping sites, but as sort of, you know, resting places for pilgrims and for walkers?
Absolutely. I was going to say there is the champing, there is the idea of pilgrimage.
Champing, do you call it?
Champing is, yes, church camping.
Right, okay.
That's the CCP term. So that, of course, that is another way of you know, people coming through the doors, and you get to see these wonderful buildings. But that's true as well. Could we not have them as, in fact, hospitiums, you know, the old type hospitals where pilgrims would come along and rest for the night? It's the exact same idea that the way that we used to use them in the medieval era. Nothing has changed. Why not use them in that same way? I don't think there's anything particularly wrong with it if they are not being used for worship on a regular basis. I think it's...
Yeah, we should definitely just encourage people to visit them as well this Easter. And so you mentioned cathedrals. You're working on a book at the moment. Could you tell us a bit about that?
My next book is called Heaven on Earth, The Lives and Legacies of the World's Greatest Cathedrals. And it looks at 20 of the world's, what I think are the world's greatest cathedrals, particularly, it's largely our medieval cathedrals across Europe. It's not certainly not just Britain, across Europe. And I'm trying to look at and trying to discover not only the art and architecture, which, you know, a lot of books are focused on the past, which is absolutely wonderful. I mean, I'm certainly looking at that, but I want to know more about who the people were behind these great buildings, who created this wonderful fabric, you know, the stories behind these majestic marvels, which are some of the most epic sagas in our history. They teem with extraordinary cast of characters. And, you know, we have so many chronicles about the builders, the style and the construction. So I'm trying to bring this all together, but under one roof, pardon the pun, the living histories of the sort of unexamined details, to bring a fresh interpretation of these feats of imagination, engineering, mystery that we all think we know so very well. It's looking at the lives, the legends, and also the scandals, because there are some fantastic stories behind how they were built and the people who built them. You know, it's a human story, I suppose, set against some of the most astonishing achievements of Western culture.
Final question. So you're getting out and about quite a lot. You're seeing a lot of the British landscape. Where do you love to go to escape from the dusty books of academia or the tedious news on the radio? Where do you go for a lovely a break? Where could you recommend?
I love to go to, I'm a bit biased, but the Yorkshire Dales, Wensleydale particularly. I love to wander, again, biased, but I love to wander particularly the sites, you know, walk from castle to castle. There are some absolutely fantastic ones with some great Tudor history up here. We're often forgotten up here for our Tudor history, but we have Catherine Parr's, one of her homes. We have where Mary, Queen of Scots, was held, all within an absolutely beautiful landscape. And that's where I like to walk and like to visit.
Brilliant. I think that's a good place to leave it. But thanks so much.
Yes, thank you. Bye.
Well, I hope that whets your appetite for a holy hike this year, whether you are religious or not. And a huge thanks to Emma Wells for her expertise and enthusiasm. And Emma will be joining the magazine on a more regular basis later in the year, offering insight into key historical events that have shaped the countryside. Plus, she's even going to walk a pilgrimage route for us.
Thank you also to Hannah Tribe for mastering the Old English prologue from Geoffrey Chaucer's Canterbury Tales. And you can find hundreds more walks, articles about the countryside and insight into the Countryfile TV programme on our website, countryfile.com. I hope you've enjoyed this podcast. Please subscribe at Acast and iTunes, and we've got plenty of more adventures coming up later this year. Thanks for listening. Bye.